Canada is fortunate, and in particular the Prairie Provinces are fortunate, in having had in Sarah Binks a writer whose lyrical voice could not only express the difficulties and the efforts and even the hardships of the prairie farmer during the early days of Saskatchewan, when it was just being opened up for wheat, but she was also, to quote her biography, very much aware of the beauty of field and sky and rain-drenched hill, of prairie swept by storm, of dazzling alkali flat, of hot fallow land in the sun of the summer afternoon, of the misty pastels of spreading time. She spoke always of the age in which she lived, and of her farm, and of her environment, and although she has been called the sweet songstress of Saskatchewan, that province can claim her only geographically. She is actually the voice of the Prairie West and of the wheatlands from the pre-Cambrian shield of Manitoba to the foothills of Alberta. As a poetess, Sarah Binks was always very conscious of her own talents. Early in life, when she was writing such trivial poems as Calf and Goose and My Garden, she was already anticipating some of the recognition which was to come to her much later. And in those charming lines of self-revelation in which she confesses some of the technical difficulties of writing poetry and in making things rhyme, she nevertheless feels that she is at one with all art, whether it's expressed in literature, music, or painting, or merely in being or living the artistic life. "I'm a genius," she declares, and she desires nothing more. "I'm a genius, I'm a genius. What more can I desire? I toot upon my little flute and twang upon my lyre. I dabble in oil paints, in cinnabar and ochre. All night I'm dissipated and play poker. In my little book, in my little book, I write verses. Sometimes they don't rhyme. Curses." Two of the best known of Sarah's poems illustrating the life on the farm of Saskatchewan in the early days are "The Farmer is King." It's a joyful paean of praise of the farmer's freedom and independence. And the other is "The Farmer and the Farmer's Wife," in which the happiness of farming is extolled. But it ends on a somber note. "The farmer is king of his packer and plow, of his harrow and binders and breakers. He is lord of the pig and czar of the cow on his 160-odd acres. The farmer is monarch in high estate of his barns and his backhouse and byre, and all the buildings behind the gate of his 2-odd miles of barbed wire. The farmer is even Caesar of freight, tariff and tax comes election, and from then until then he can abdicate and be king on his own quarter section. The farmer is king, oh, the farmer is king, and except for his wife and his daughter who boss him around, he runs the thing, come drought, come hell or high water." The other poem in the same vein tells of the joy which the farmer leads in his family life when he works together with his wife. "The farmer and the farmer's wife lead frolicsome and carefree lives, and all their work is but in play, their labor's only exercise. The farmer leaps from bed to board and board to binder on the land. His wife awakes with shouts of joy and milks a cow with either hand. Then, all in fun, they feed the pigs and plow the soil in reckless glee and play the quaint old-fashioned game of mortgager and mortgagee. And all day long they dash about in barn and pasture, field and heath. She sings a merry roundelay, he whistles gaily through his teeth. And when at night the chores are done, and hand in hand they sit and beam, he helps himself to Applejack, and she to Paris Green." Paris Green here is not to be taken seriously. Sarah never intended that it should be. It's merely a poetic symbol of fatigue after the day's activities, and perhaps also a bit of depression, a feeling which Sarah herself was to share since she had to help her father and Ole with the chores. The very fact that she writes as longingly for a hired man to assist her seems to indicate that there were times when she wishes that she had less to do and could devote more of her time to literature. "Where shall I find a hired man?" she cries out on one occasion, and she indicates the many activities round the place in which she was often called to help. "Where shall I find a hired man for homely destiny to toil, to mend harnesses, to shovel cement and boil oil? Where shall I find a hired man to gather rocks and do the chores, to harrow wide and plow deep the big outdoors? Where shall I find a hired man with simple passion for his job, with thoughts of work and nothing else within his knob? Where shall I search for a hired man with corded arms and knotted knees and beamed shoulders and feet like Hercules. Sarah was a great reader. She read everything she could lay her hands on, and this accounts for her sometimes venturing outside of her own locale, and she sometimes makes mistakes in her facts, or perhaps it would be better to say that she gives to facts which had not come within her own experience a new Saskatchewan flavor. Storm at Sea is definitely a case in point. Sarah had never been to the sea. Indeed, she had never been further away from home than Regina. But the storm she describes, despite its technical errors from a sailor's standpoint, or perhaps even because of them, had thus become a Saskatchewan storm. Moreover, since she had been so blown around on the platform the day she was presented with the horse thermometer that she had been mistaken for the dancer Lolita, she despises the wind, and she introduces a definite personal note which gives to the wind a sinister and destructive quality. Here it is. A hail for the sailor who puts to sea when the wind is right and the sky is free, but shed a tear for his sweetheart, too, if he isn't home in a month or two. And shed more tears for the sailor lad when the wind is east and the weather's bad. Then it's into your woolies and heave my bullies and wind up the sails and pull up the pulleys and shout together, ship ahoy, it's going to blow, and boy, oh boy. The storm clouds gather, the rigging hums, the captain shudders, and here she comes. Ripping the shingles from off the deck, the wind grows louder and louder, by heck. Ah, many a vessel has been submersed and gone to the bottom, caboose end first. So it's heave, my hearties, and yell, my hearties, and slug and batter the bell, my hearties, and send out the SOL, my hearties. The storm is at its worst. Ah, many a sailor, when help is past, is gone to the bottom, caboose end last. And many a weeping sweetheart, too, has counted and waited a month or two, has counted and waited a month at least, and written him off as predeceased. So belay, my buddy, and stay, my buddy, and let them bloody well weigh, my buddy, and stay or stow away, my buddy, when the wind is in the east. Sarah not only wrote about her farm life and the scenes around her, but she was also very much aware of the romantic quality of the history of the province in which she lived, its geological development, its first settlers, the Indians, the mound builders, the Romans, all provided her poetic imagination with the inspiration for poems, in the same manner as the love affair between Matilda Schwanzhocker and Steve Grizzly Kick had provided her with themes for poetry. Certainly Sarah's error in confusing her British and Canadian histories, both of which were taught in the schools at the time, and thus giving Saskatchewan a Roman occupation, is a classic error. But literature, as so often happens, was enriched thereby. Without her Romans in Saskatchewan, we would not have had Balbus, in which the manufacture of the famous 40 rod, which is a popular drink of that day, is described. And in her Here Comes Caesar, which is one of her finest poems, she sees Caesar as she often saw the premier or other local statesman at the municipal fairs which she invariably attended. Moreover, we are given a glimpse not only of the statesmen themselves, but also in the chorus of the bystanders, of the citizen who applaud him and their admiration for his having made good. And it is in such insights, with their lyrical quality, that Sarah really justifies her title of being the laureate of Saskatchewan. Here is Here Comes Caesar. Here comes Caesar, pound the drums, blow the bagpipes, Caesar comes. Crowd the platform, pull up tight, yep, that's him, the Honorable Caesar, all right. The one with the badge and the bag of fixtures. Yes, that's Caesar, just like his pictures. His are the cares and the joys of state, a good man to know and to emulate. And then follows that famous chorus of the bystanders in which the advantages of office are outlined. Caesar is Caesar for all that's in it, a job in the census, a seat in the Senate, an office east, a farm on the prairie, a pass on the train with his secretary, a boat in the bay, and a band like Sousa's, and a suite full of starry-eyed Lollapaloozas. That Lollapaloozas is an out-of-date word today. They knew it in those days. Sarah has a surprising talent for making the form and meter of her poetry fit the subject matter with which she is dealing. For example, the lovely lilting quality of her The Invitation to the Dance is equaled only in The Square Dance. In The Invitation to the Dance, she seems to be concerned chiefly with the dance itself and the pleasure derived from it. But in The Square Dance, we are given an insight into the ethnic mosaic of the community in which she lived, and something of the social customs. Here first is The Invitation to the Dance. Come tread me a measure, I give you the pleasure, the one step, the two step, or three, the polka so tender you'll always remember with joy if you tread it with me. You'll be glad that we met, to the clarionet we will swing and we'll twist on the floor. With a bound we will mount to the middle and count, one, two, three, one, two, three, four. She may have been a little uncertain of the particular dance she was engaged in here, and apparently she had to count, as uncertain dancers sometimes have to do. But she certainly caught the lilt and the beat and the music of the dance itself. But notice how much greater in her self-assurance is The Square Dance, which she wrote much later. Just about the time, in fact, when she wrote Washout on the Line, in which she also indicates some of the social customs, as well as the local gossip from a consideration of the lines on wash day. In The Square Dance, I always think it is particularly fascinating in that one verse names the girls taking part, and they're quite evidently from a different ethnic background than the groups in the second. Moreover, the old frontier custom of tying a handkerchief to the arm of one of the men when there were not enough ladies to go around was observed in the case of Squiffy Malarty. And it's a poem with tremendous verve in which the swing of the square dance has certainly been caught. Sing ho for the dance to shuffle and prance, sing ladies do-si-do, and fiddles engage with birds in the cage, sing eleven left, sing ho. Oh, give me the square where harmonicas blare and the ladies are set for the swing. And Squiffy Malarty has made up the party with a handkerchief tied to his wing. Swing Olga, swing Lena, swing Kate and Katrina, swing Gudrun and Bjorg and Gertrude. Swing heavy, swing hearty, swing Squiffy Malarty, the life of the party and stewed. Oh, give me the dance where the girls take a chance with seam and with button and string. So swing them up higher before they retire. Sing ho, hi ho for the swing. Sing ho for the swirls and the breathless girls and the swimming delight in their eyes. Come smaller or taller, take off the collar. Sing ho for the exercise. Swing Daisy, swing Betty, swing Maisie and Letty, swing Mirabel, Margie and Joy. Swing Mrs. McGinty 6 feet and squinty 220 in court. We all have our own choices in the matter of Sarah's poems, but to me, probably because of my own Indian background, the most appealing are those of the Indian days. They seem to fall into two classes, as I suppose rightly they should. They are the heroic ones, like Eagle Feather and Hordes of Sheep, and there are those sweetly lyrical ones, like Hunter's Moon and Little Papoose, and the one in which Moon in the Eyes MacDonald is in love with one of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police. In Hunter's Moon, the Indian maiden calls to her lover, and in Little Papoose, we have a charming picture of a young native mother giving her infant daughter some food as she sings it to sleep. And I read you first Hunter's Moon. Red brother, wandering wild and free. Tonight it's hunter's moon, brother, how about hunting me? Hunter's moon is low, brother, so hang up the bow of wood. Hunter's moon will show, brother, where the hunting's good. Hunter's moon is pale, brother, hark from bush and nook. A wild voice calls, brother, you won't have long to look. Here is Little Papoose, that sweet one of motherhood. Little Papoose, the twilight creeping, draws its shadows across the skies. Another hour and you'll be sleeping. Here's a pickle, close your eyes. Little Papoose, the daylight passes, and soon the night will be full of dreams, and you'll be full of bread and molasses and stewed dried apples and tinned sardines. Little Papoose, the night grows blacker, and you'll be round as a young balloon, with 2 cups of tea and 15 crackers and a double handful of Saskatoons. In Hordes of Sheep, we are shown the Red Brother in a more heroic mold. And again, Sarah makes the historic mistake of confusing a herd of sheep with the herds of buffaloes of the Indians' early days. And again, we must overlook her error when we consider her splendid poetry. After all, as her biographer points out, Sarah was writing not a history, but a literature. And incidentally, this poem, Hordes of Sheep, was the runner-up in the McCowan and Myers poetry competition, which she won her first great honor, the horse thermometer. 'Tis night on the prairie, a night on the plain, and all is still, no sign of rain, and all is peace, and deep in his teepee the red man sleeps and the squaw is sleepy. The red man snores with the red man's cunning, but hark, what's that? It's the sound of running. 'Tis the sound of rushing and hurrying feet. Hark, what's that? 'Tis the sound of bleat. Louder it comes, it rises wild. Ah, the mother hears it and grabs her child. Louder still, the frantic mother grabs her child, and another, and the red man, waked by that hurrying tread, turns deadly pale beneath his red. The Indian brave is aroused from sleep. Run for your life, boys, here come sheep. Notice now the change of pace in the second verse with the passage of time. A night of terror, the desolate dawn sees many a brave that was trampled on. And nothing grows where the sheep have passed, but things that come must go at last. And the years roll by, and it's once more night. But where is that echoing tread of fright? That thundering horde that swept like fire is bits of wool on the barbed wire. And the monarch has traded his high estate for bed and board and the right to mate, and gives his wool quite meek and mild for the red man's wife for her latest child. And soundly the brave on his reservation sleeps in his woolen combinations. In the end, the Red Brother adapts himself to farm life, which in Sarah's hands we would naturally expect him to do. Sarah lifts the Red Brother from Longfellow's poem Hiawatha, which she had read in school and had greatly admired, puts him to work on the chores. In this case, he is milking a cow. The poem is very appropriately called Hiawatha's Milking. Give me of your milk, O moo cow, of your pure white juice, O doo cow, reasonably white and not too blue cow. Give me rich white milk, O Flossie, she whom men sometimes call bossy, she whom men sometimes call kobos, sometimes sobos, sometimes hobos. Kick me not, nor pale, I pray cow, or I'll bust you one from here to Krakow. And the cow whom men call kobos, sometimes sobos, sometimes hobos, shuddering in all her branches, trembling like the wild Comanches, turned upon him eyes of doleful, eyes of sadness, eyes of soulful, breathing deeply to inhale full, kicked him neatly in the pailful, slapped him across the face with tailful, saying with a sigh of sorrow, take my milk, oh hi, tomorrow, take my milk, oh Hiawatha, try and get it, Hiawatha. In a way, it's a sad poem to which Sarah was not often given. But then Sarah was aware of the fact that the Red Brother was disappearing from the plains, and in Hiawatha's frustration and defeat, she expresses some of her sorrow for their passing. Much more lively is the well-known Hi Suki, well-known because it has found its way into every schoolbook of the West. In Hi Suki, Sarah gives a poetic quality to the simple chore of feeding the pigs, which is not generally so poetically regarded. In fact, it may be said that she has sublimated the chore. One feels on reading it that even the pigs have taken on something of a spiritual quality, which they have seldom said to have possessed. Actually, in a deeper sense, it is a love poem, since it is cast in the form of a young lover, Steve Grizzly Kick in this case, observing and studying the object of his love, Sarah's friend Matilda, from afar. Oh, I heard your voice at daybreak, calling loud and sweet and clear. I was hiding in the turnips with a cricket in my ear, a miller moth in one ear, a cricket in the other. Yet I heard your dear voice calling to the piglets and their mother. Heard your own voice rising, falling, loud and long and sharp and shrill, calling Suki, Suki, Suki to the piglets on the hill. Hi, Suki, ho, Suki, come and get your swill. Oh, I hid among the turnips, and I hid between the stooks, with barley barbs all down my back and beetles in my boots. And I've seen you in the dwindling, and I've seen you in the rain, with an armful full of kindling when you fell and rose again. I've seen you plodding through the dust and plugging through the wet, and at night against the wind a blind I've seen your silhouette. But Suki, 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 I never can forget. Hi, Suki, ho, Suki, come and get your pep. And oh, I think I'll hide again for just a sight of you and hear your own sweet voice again called Suki, Suki, Su. Hi, Suki, ho, Suki, come and get the stew, Suki. Come and get your goo, Suki. Suki, Suki, Su. This is the poem of which Professor Marafat of the English Department at St. Midget's once said, another poem like that and Sarah could give the whole Hey Nonny Nonny School of Poetry aces and jacks, and it richly deserves that praise. Once or twice, Sarah tried her hand at translations. She was certainly not bilingual, but her best friend, Matilda, was German and had a German-English dictionary. And several of their translations have come down to us, but on the whole, they're not very successful. The two girls sometimes guessed at the meaning of words, and in their effort to be true to the original, they generally lost the poetic spirit of the poetry they were translating. On only one occasion was real success achieved, and that was in the translation of Heine's Du bist wie eine Blume. In this case, it is generally conceded by students of German literature that she definitely improved on the original. You are like one flower, so swell, so good and clean. I look you on, and longing slinks me the heart between. Me is as if the hand's eye on head yours put them should, praying that God you preserve, so swell, so clean and good. Another of Sarah's translations, not as successful, in which she literally translates the river Rhine as the river clean, and she translates the Lorelei as the laurel's egg, is this. I know not what shall it betoken that I so sorrowful seem, a marklet from out of old spoken that comes me not out of the bean. The loft is cool, and it darkles, and ruefully floweth the clean. The top of the mountaintop sparkles in evening sunshine sheen. The fairest young woman sitteth there wonderful up on top. Her golden-like outfit glitteth, she combeth her golden mop. She combs it with golden combful, and sings one song there too, that has one wonderful, wonderful, and powerful toodle-dee-doo. The shipper in very small shiplet begrabs it with very wild cry. He looks not the rock and the riplet, he looks but up top on the high. I believe that the whales will devour the end of the shipper and ship, and that has in her singing bower the laurel's egg done it. A poem which has found its way into the hearts of all prairie dwellers in Western Canada, especially if they are wheat farmers, as they all were in Sarah's day, is that lovely and lyrical song of the four seasons. She begins naturally with spring. Spring is here, the breeze is blowing, 4 inches of topsoil going, going, washtubs rolling across the prairie. Spring is here, how nice and airy. Summer has come, the hoppers are back, the sun shines bright and the fields shine black. Cloudlets gather, it looks like rain. Ah, the patter of hail on the windowpane. Bounteous harvest, we'll sell at cost. Tonight we'll have an early frost. Glorious autumn, red with rust, and we'll live at the general store on trust. Notice the change of pace where Sarah changes over to winter. A long, quiet winter with plenty of snow, and plenty of barley, it's 80 below. Barley in the heater, salt pork in the pantry. How nice that you never feel the cold in this country. I close, as Sarah closed her great work, up from the magma and back again, with 4 lines from an old mission song, which in this day when we are dealing so much with the early days of the CPR across Canada and the ceremonies and speeches which marked the finish of that equally great enterprise. And it is called The Last Spike, and it's most appropriate. Now is the last spike driven, now is the last tie riven, now is the last speech given. Let's all go home.